Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We are looking over our shoulders as we start looking at the government's tyrannical responses to, and I understand that some people would say, hey, this is it's a good thing that our government is taking care of us, but to be assured, the government we have is taking care of itself. It is not taking care of us. If our government was to take care of us, it would allow the states to have their powers back. And so, under the guise of a pandemic, and I wasn't broadcasting at the time when the Ebola virus was becoming a real threat and everybody was really concerned that we were all going to die. And I'm not trying to marginalize the death toll that's coming from this disease, but I am going to tell you that if you look at how they have done tests and so forth, there is a design by very evil people to get rid of a lot of people. The Georgia Guidestones basically lay out the maximum amount of people that should live on this earth is 500 million, a half a billion. Well, that means a lot of people have to die, my friends. And I think biblically, we've been told that in the last days or before the second coming, 2/3 of the people on earth will die. Now, I don't want to, start anything other than the fact that if we're going to face a pandemic, if we're going to do these types of things, the federal government has to follow the Constitution, period. And so what it should be doing, and if Trump was smart, he would have started rebuilding the militias and ensuring that the states had everything that they needed to be able to to create whatever measures that the state needed to take. Because bottom line, there is nothing in the Constitution that gives the federal government the power to call for martial law without the militia. As we've read through the ratification debates, they are synonymous. You have to call and deploy the militia, not the National Guard, not the U.S. Army, not any of the federal standing army enforcement agencies. It is the militia. And that's why Article 1, Section 8 is really clear on that. So bottom line is, if Trump was smart, he would have started building and at least now get off the pot and start building the state militias and telling the states, you know what, we're dismantling this unconstitutional National Guard thing, and we're going to restore you your militia so that you in every single county have a militia instead of, because if you look, the counties, and it's deliberate, there are counties that have no militia, no representation, or no funding. Every county has to have an integral part of the state militias because, you never know, that part of the county may need to have roadblocks, road checks, or what have you, in enforcing state laws and so forth. The problem is that the state legislatures do not understand, the responsibilities they're supposed to have, and they're just trying to do everything they can to serve themselves so that they can get to the next power trough so that they can make more money. Most politicians are self-serving. That's why this coming year, this election, and don't be surprised if we don't have an election. Now, I will not be predicting that, but I mean, the federal government and those power brokers will do anything and everything they can to to try to protect their power. I mean, we saw that there have been no stops with the DNC and the Democratic Party. I've even heard rumor, and you'll love this, I've heard rumor that the ticket, the Democratic ticket, when everything is said and done, will be Hillary and Michelle Obama. And I'm going, I don't know where Circus Maximus is going to end, but it is the greatest show on earth, because we're watching a wholesale buy-in by the fringe radical left who want a fringe radical ticket. And so I've called it out. The Democrats are, what's the best word for it? They have no shame in being a communist. Now, every single one of these folks that are communists, I've said this before, they should all be removed from office. They should, their qualifications for office should, you know, they should not meet the qualifications, because what they're calling for is they're calling for rebellion against the U.S. Constitution. That's unconstitutional. As a matter of fact, it violates Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Anyway, we have 12 citations left for the Virginia ratification debates. And so we might actually get through them this week. And then we'll get into the New York debates. And then if you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org's webpage, the Red State Talk Radio webpage, you'll see what the things we will be releasing and talking and more granularity, more fidelity will be coming out as to what we'll be, you know, putting up first and so forth, as far as interviews and discussions and so forth. Anyway, excuse me. You are listening to the only show that is providing the academic-based evidence of what we need to do if we're going to save our liberties. Are we going to surrender to a government that promises it's going to protect us and never deliver? It's the same thing as giving powers and money and constraints to your local enforcement, whether that be police or what have you, and saying, okay, this is going to be a gun-free city because the police promised to protect us, and then more and more people die from unlawful gun use because they can't protect you. We have a responsibility to protect ourselves, and we have a responsibility to defend the Constitution. It's about time America starts waking up and understands that this is a self-governing system, and we have to become integral in self-governing, period. There's no other way around it. Anyway, this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And I will also just plug one more thing. We do have, because I haven't said this in a long time, we do have Red State Coffee. If you happen to be one who, you know, tips the cup with coffee, go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org's website. Right there on the main page, it'll give you a link that you can go. If you enjoy coffee, and as a matter of fact, use it as a great, you know, conversation piece, is, you know, starting the conversation off with your liberal friends and say, hey, what do you think of that coffee? That's Red State Coffee. Anywho, with that, we want to dive into the ratification debates. And this last one is, we're just finishing up what George Nicholas was saying. And they were going through these concepts of trial by jury and all of that type of stuff regarding the Bill of Rights. And he was kind of knocking off these big factors of, you know, how the, you know, the Constitution is protecting us from ex post facto laws, Bill of Attainders, and those types of things. And he talks, what he's talking now is about excessive bails and fines, which is, I believe that's the Eighth Amendment, where we're protected from excessive bails and fines in the Bill of Rights. But anyway, he says, excuse me, as to the exclusion of excessive bails and fines and cruel and unusual punishments, this would follow of itself without a Bill of Rights. Observations have been made without watchfulness over those in power, which deserve our attention. There must be a combination, we must presume, corruption in the House of Representatives, Senate, and President before we suppose that excessive fines can be imposed on cruel punishment inflicted. The number is the highest security. Numbers are in the highest security in our own Constitution, which has attracted so many eulogiums from the gentleman. Here we have launched into a sea of suspicions. How shall we have a check of power? By their members. Before these cruel punishments can be inflicted, laws must be passed and judges must judge contrary to justice. This would excite universal discontent and detestation of the members of the government. They might involve their friends in the calamities resulting from it and could be removed from office. I never desire a greater security than this, which I believe to be absolutely sufficient. Now, I've gone on the record of saying that our entire penal system, our entire bail system, charges, fines, and those types of things are completely out of whack. Let's say you live in a part of the state where you're not making a lot of money. Let's say, but you live comfortably, and you're living at the average income. And let's just say the average income in the area where I live is about $60,000. And let's say you have people that live well north of that as far as their average income. And let's say on a given night, you happen to over imbibe, and so did this other person. And this other person, let's say, makes millions of dollars, and you make $60,000 a year. And you both, you know, get pulled over for a DUI. What should the penal system do? And so with that, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so what do you do? What is the fair justice system when it comes to the unfortunate dumb decision by an individual that they thought that they, you know, after getting drunk, they get behind the wheel and drive their vehicle? Now, if you got somebody that's making millions of dollars, and you've got somebody, then their lifestyles are obviously different, but they make the same dumb mistake. And you have a bail system that you have to pay, let's say $100,000. Well, that could be a real diverse impact on a person that's only making $60,000 a year. They may be trapped in jail and unable to, you know, sustain their family, in contrast to the guy that makes $1 million. Shoot, he's written the check and he's gone already. Or I should say millions of dollars. Our system, if you commit the same crime, you should have to face a very similar process of, you know, feeling pain. Now, if it's $100,000, that means that that's 100% plus, almost one point 25% or something like that of the person's income. And so that's what the millionaire should have to pay as well, 1.25% of their income. So in other words, their bail may be, $2, $3, $4 million. And that's how it should be, because the magnitude for your dumb decision putting people at risk should be equal to you. That's why, if you look, the stars, you know, our penal system does not control the opulent. It only scares the death out of the minions. But if we had a fair system, then the pain would be felt equally regarding the same kind of mistake. Legislators need to be very proactive in doing this. And oh, by the way, just because it comes to mind, and I harangue on this a bit, you should start contacting your state legislatures while they're in session right now and ask them how much revenue is coming into the state from Google, from Facebook, and from all these other tech companies that are throwing ads into your state over that wire we call the internet. Because they're making money operating in your state on the internet. If you're clicking on something, somebody just made some money regarding that click, that pay for click, and that's revenue made in your state. Why is it that the state governments have failed to go after those who are actually making money in your state, but they don't seem to be in your state? And, you know, it's funny how the state legislatures had pressured, and South Dakota was behind all of this, pressured the federal government in allowing the state legislatures to go after income tax, in other words, going after you, the people, while corporations are making billions of dollars in revenue because the usage of the internet. Every website, every time you click on an ad, every time there is a pay-per-click or what have you, that all needs to be recorded. And you know what? It would probably be a little bit of an accounting nightmare for these conglomerate and these large global high-tech companies. But who cares? They're making revenue. The laws are, if you're making money in the state, you have to pay for that. It doesn't matter if you have a presence or not. Anyway, let me just move forward, and we're going to head down to the next citation. Now, this happens to be on Wednesday, June 18th, and this is George Nicholas. It's a short little quip, but he hoped that the committee would not advert to this, that the Army and Navy were to be raised by Congress and not by the president. It was on the same footing with our state governments for the governor, with the council was to embody the militia. But when actually embodied, they were under the sole command of the governor. So if you really want to understand how things worked and how, you know, how the militia functioned and so forth, you know, these documents have so much insight. The instance adduced was not similar. General Washington was not a president as to a possible danger any commander might attempt to pervert, what was intended for the common defense of the community to its destruction. The president, at the end of 4 years, was to relinquish all his offices, but if any person was to have the command, the time would not be limited, and it would only be there would be a limitation, because once the conflict or once the need has ceased, the need for commanding would cease as well. So anyway, as we move down to the next one, now this is Governor Randolph, and this is another short quip. The honorable gentleman says that if you place treaties on the same footing here as they are in England, he will consent to the power because the king is restrained in making treaties. Will not the president and senate be restrained? Being creatures of that constitution, can they destroy it? Can any particular body instituted for a particular purpose destroy the existence of the society for whose benefit it is created? It is said that there is no limitation of treaties. I defy the wisdom of that gentleman to show how they ought to be limited. And I will clearly tell you that the limitation of the treaties can only be that you can't make a treaty over something you have no authority. In other words, if I make a treaty, I can't make a treaty that encompasses you sacrificing your land because I don't possess the authority over your land. The treaties were limited to the enumerated powers. And so people, you know, don't understand the whole concept of treaties that were being made were over foreign exchange and foreign trade and currencies exchange and those types of things. They weren't supposed to be, and nor did they have the power. The federal government does not have the power to put up on a treaty your right to bear arms. They're constrained from being able to do anything regarding your right to bear arms. So they can't be entering into treaties as they had with Hillary in trying to introduce treaties as, you know, putting a restriction on the amount of guns you can own, the type of guns you can own, or what have you. And they've tried to use these mechanisms as backdoors. They don't have the authority over that. They can't come to the table and say, I'm bringing stuff I have no authority to, but I'm going to promise it to you anyway. They only have the authority over the enumerated powers, and it's only those powers that they can put on the table for a treaty. So anyway, Governor Randolph continues and says, when the Constitution marks out the powers to be exercised by particular departments, I say no innovation can take place. An honorable gentleman says, the Great Charter of America, if so, will not the last clause of the fourth article of the Constitution secure against dismemberment? It provides that nothing in this Constitution shall be construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or any particular state. So in other words, particular states have their claims over those things that are theirs. And the problem is that we have, all of these things that the federal government is trampling upon that are states' rights, they're states' property. And these treaties and some of these other things that the federal government is doing, they have no business doing, and the state legislatures need to stand up. Now, sadly, I have found out that in Oklahoma and South Dakota, at least South Dakota, the bill has failed. That in trying to get constitutional enforcement, and I've reached out to Representative Johnson, and so hopefully we can, you know, work with him in gaining consensus and building a movement in South Dakota that's calling for full compliance to the Constitution. Folks, you want to solve your problems? It only comes when the federal government is in compliance to the Constitution, doing those things that they have the authority to do, not the things that they have usurped. And so, as a matter of fact, the only thing that the federal government should be doing regarding the global pandemic is shutting down any flights, anything at all between these countries that had these effects or infections. They should have just shut that down, period. And so people that were flowing, you know, when you travel at your own risk. I know that when I was in the Marine Corps and we got on boats and we traveled around, those guys that went ashore and they went out into the populace, they did so at their own risk. And 9 times out of 10, if there was a high risk of venereal disease or a high risk of disease of any type, you were basically kept on base or kept on ship. You did not get out and do liberty call, regardless, because the last thing the military wants is to have somebody come along and infect an entire cadre of ships and a battle fleet or what have you. Are you kidding? So anyway, let me just kind of move on. If it provides that nothing in this Constitution will be construed as to the prejudice, the claims of the United States in a particular state, and if this did not constitute security, it follows from the nature of civil association that no particular part shall sacrifice the whole. And so they understood the concept that even though these treaties may become the supreme law, they can only become the supreme law in the context that the government already had those powers to create those treaties with. I can't go along and promise your money, your accounts, or anything that you're doing in a treaty so that you have to surrender those things that I had no power over. Anyway, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TALK-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's, and if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, this next comment is regarding the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, and Mr. Pendleton is piping in regarding some jurisdiction, and he says the this next clause settles the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, confining it to two cases, that of ambassadors, ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party. In other words, let's say a state may be in a party to an international case regarding products, trades, or what have you. It excludes its original jurisdiction in other cases, but it appears to me that it would not restrain Congress from regulating even those as to permit foreign ambassadors to sue in the inferior courts or even to compel them to do so where their clause may be trivial or they have where their cause may be trivial or they have no reason or they have no reason to expect a partial trial. Notwithstanding this jurisdiction is given to the Supreme Court, yet Congress may go further by their laws so as to exclude its original jurisdiction by limiting the cases wherein it shall be exercised. So Congress has the ability, but they cannot expand jurisdiction. They can constrain it more. they may require some satisfactory evidence of the party could not expect a fair trial in the inferior court. I am struck with this view from considering the legislature is not excluded by the general jurisdiction in the Constitution from regulating it to accommodate the convenience of the people. Yet the legislature cannot extend its original jurisdiction, which is limited to these cases, as well as we've already been told. It is limited to the enumerated powers. In other words, let's just say that there is a clash between states regarding marriage. Now, the federal government may have a stake in the Supreme Court between the issues, between the commerce issues of one state to the next, such as, let's walk down this path. So if you have one state that is providing all these benefits, full benefits for homosexual marriage, and somebody leaves that state to go to another state and then tries to sue that state, that would be not within the jurisdiction. However, let's say one state tried to sue the other state to say, hey, because, and I'm just going to use this as an example, Vancouver, Washington, and Portland, Oregon. There's a lot of exchange and commerce. A lot of people work in Portland, but they live in Vancouver because of the taxes. Let's say somebody gets married, and or let's say that, you know, one state has homosexual marriage and the other one doesn't. And then all of a sudden, the people that are, you know, working over there that are getting the benefits, let's say Portland, Oregon, and Oregon State was the one that's provided all these benefits. And so, but the companies weren't paying. And so maybe because these people were residents of the state of Washington, I can't figure out how they could get the Supreme Court to force a state to recognize something that they have no enumerated power, even when it is between state to state. Even if the state of Oregon tried to sue, the jurisdiction should be held and standing that state of Washington is sovereign, that they can govern their people and they don't have to provide those benefits. And therefore, the companies can continue to withhold benefits for people that are residing in that state. You want to have these benefits, you have to live in this state. And that's how it should be. But the federal government, when it comes down to an opportunity to make an activist type of ruling regarding any type of case, well, I mean, they never balk at that. They're going to stand up and go, yeah, let us expand our reach and encroach more and more upon the jurisdiction and sovereignty of states. And as a matter of fact, Thomas Sowell, I believe, was the one of many who has commented they have never turned down the opportunity to expand and self-aggrandize their powers. Now, this next one's a long one, and so this will probably take the rest of the show because it's pretty long. This is Mr. Madison, and they're starting off Friday, June 20th, and they're getting close towards the end here of the ratification debate. So there's some pretty long discourses by each of these orators, and here is Mr. Madison. He says, Mr. Chairman, permit me to make a few observations which may place this part in a more favorable light than the gentleman placed it yesterday. It may be proper to remark that the organization of the general government for the United States was, in all its parts, very difficult. There was a peculiar difficulty in that the executive, everything incident to it, must have participated in that difficulty, that the mode which was judged most expedient was adopted till experience should point out one or more eligible. This part was also attended with the difficulties. It claims the indulgence of fair and liberal interpretation. I will not deny that. According to my view of the subject, a more accurate attention may be placed in terms which would exude some of the objections now made by it. But if we take a liberal construction, I think we shall find nothing dangerous or inadmissible in it. In comparisons of this kind, it is difficult to avoid technical terms which have the same meaning. In attention to this may satisfy gentlemen, the precision was not so easily obtained as I might imagine. I will illustrate this by one thing in the Constitution. There is a general power to provide courts to try felonies and piracies committed on the high seas. Piracy is a word which was considered as a term of the law of nations. Felony is a word unknown to the law of nations and is to be found in the British laws and from thence adopted to the laws of these states. It was thought dishonorable to have recourse to that standard. A technical term of the law of nations is therefore used that we should find ourselves authorized to induce it into the laws of the United States. The first question which I shall consider is whether the subjects of its cognizance be proper subjects of a federal jurisdiction. The second will be whether the provisions expecting it be consistent with safety and propriety will answer the purposes intended and suit local circumstances. Now, you got to understand that the background on this is that when it came to criminal behavior, the federal government had no jurisdiction over, you know, all criminal behavior. They were limited to treason, counterfeiting, and these particular crimes that he just mentioned. Piracies and felonies and piracies committed on the high seas. And so Madison goes on and says that the first class of cases in which its jurisdiction extends are those which may arise under this Constitution. And this is the extend to, this is to extend to equity as well as law. It may be, and to understand equity and law, you know, those are legal terms that you really have to understand, and we're going to actually get into those later. I don't want to get into that now because it'll just detract from going through this. But when we talk to John Durash in that interview, he starts talking about that. And we're going to actually have a follow-on interview. So we're going to be diving into equity and law and what these things mean and why these things are important in setting up a legal framework and how we're supposed to, you know, not only just govern ourselves, but how we're supposed to obey and prosecute. And so anyway, it may be a misfortune that in organizing any government, the explication of its authority should be left to any of its coordinate branches. There is no example in any country where it is otherwise. There is a new policy in submitting to the judiciary of the United States that causes of federal nature will arise, will be obvious to every gentleman who will recollect that the states are laid under restrictions and that the rights of the Union are secured by these restrictions. Then you find those restrictions of the states in Article 1, Section 8, Article 1, Section 10. They may involve equitable as well as legal controversies. With respect to the laws of the Union, it is so necessary and expedient that the judicial power should correspond with the legislative that it has not been objected to. With respect to treaties, there is a particular propriety in the judiciary's expounding them. These may involve us in controversies with foreign nations. It is necessary, therefore, that they should be determined in the courts of the federal government. There are strong reasons why there should be a Supreme Court to decide these disputes. If any case, uniformity being necessary, it must be the exposition of treaties. The establishment of one revisionary superintending power, and we just ran out of time. So in going into the next segment, in our last segment for today, we will hopefully, let me see here. Yeah, we should be able to finish most of this and then come back to the the rest of it later. But anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
And so anyway, we're talking and covering Madison's illuminating the limitations and the reasons for the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. And so anyway, he starts off the paragraph with this. These may involve us in controversies with foreign nations. It is necessary, therefore, that they should be determined in the courts of the general government. Notice he always uses general government, not federal. There are strong reasons why there should be a Supreme Court to decide such disputes. If, in any case, uniformity be necessary, it must be in the exposition of treaties. The establishment of one revisionary superintending power can alone secure such uniformity. And so how we treat one nation compared to another nation from one side of the country to another side of the country, if it's not being done by the federal government, I understand exactly the logic that they're using. The same principle holds with respect to cases affecting ambassadors and foreign ministers. To the same principles may also be referred to their cognizance in admiralty and maritime cases. And so that's those are buzzwords for some people, because the federal government was to have jurisdiction in those courts. But you have to understand that the admiralty and maritime cases only apply under certain things, that the federal government did not create and push and force every one of us via the sovereign citizen movement underneath admiralty and maritime cases, that the states were the ones to dictate the types of laws, not the federal government. Remember, we already covered that. The common law was not imposed upon the states. It was up to, nor could the federal government impose maritime and admiralty cases or admiralty and maritime law upon the states and the people. The states had its own control, just like over slavery. The states, as a state was forming, it could choose whatever it wanted to use. And oh, by the way, they could change it. The state has the power to change what they decide to use or how they decided to, you know, whether they wanted to be a slave state or not, or, you know, its destiny. States had sovereignty over the path it was going to take. As our intercourse or as our discussion with foreign nations will be affected by decisions of this kind, they ought to be uniform. This can only be done by giving the federal judiciary exclusive jurisdiction to, so that it can maintain that uniformity. Controversies affecting the interest of the United States ought to be determined by their own judiciary and not be left to partial or local tribunals. The next case where there are two or more states or parties is not objected. Provision is made for this by the existing Articles of Confederation, and that there is no impropriety in referring such disputes to this tribunal. Excuse me. Its jurisdiction in controversies between state and citizens of another state is much objected to, and perhaps without reason. It is not the power of individuals to call any state into the court. That the only operation it can have is that if a state should wish to bring a suit against a citizen, it must be brought before the federal court. In other words, it's not to be driven by the person. It has to be driven by the state to sue or go after an individual. Let's just say if Zuckerberg was, you know, didn't have a corporation and he was the single proprietor over Facebook and was doing all of this money making, and he was residing in the state of California, but not paying taxes in all the states where he was doing business. So the states chose to sue Zuckerberg. That would be appropriate. However, if Zuckerberg was being shut down by a state and Zuckerberg wanted to sue that state but not be a resident to it, he would have no case. Anyway, this will give satisfaction to individuals as it will prevent citizens on whom a state may have a claim being dissatisfied with the state courts. It is a case which cannot often happen, and if it should be found improper, it would be altered. But it may be attended with good effects. This may be illustrated by other cases. It is provided that the citizens of different states may be carried to the federal courts. But this will not go beyond the cases where they may be parties. A feme covert, and I don't know what that means, they're talking Latin here, may be a citizen of another state, but cannot be a party in this court. A subject or a foreign power having a dispute with a citizen of the state may carry it to the federal court, but an alien enemy cannot bring suit at all. It appears to me that this can have no operation but this, to give a citizen right to be heard in the federal courts, and if a state should consider to be a party, this court may take cognizance of it. As to its cognizance of disputes between citizens of different states, I will not say it is a matter of much importance. Perhaps it might be left to the state courts, but I sincerely believe this provision will be rather sanctuary or salutary than otherwise. It may happen that a strong prejudice may arise in some states against citizens of others who may have claims against them. We know what tardy and even defective administration of justice can happen in some states. A citizen of another state might not chance to get justice in a state court, and at all events, he might think himself injured. The next clause, there is no objection. The next case provides for disputes between foreign states and one of our states. Should such a case ever arise, and between a citizen and a foreign citizen or a subject, I do not conceive that any controversy can ever be decided in these courts between an American state and a foreign state without the consent of the parties If they consent, provision is made here. The disputes ought to be tried by the national tribunal. This is consonant with the law of nations. Could there be more favorable or eligible provisions to avoid controversies with foreign powers? Now, see, they've mentioned foreign laws of nations a few times, or Madison has, and it's actually in the Constitution. So here's the question. What do you know about the laws of nations? Did you know the conquest, which actually I believe came from the crown, because, you know, the crown and, or I should say, the Royal Catholic Church, or the Roman Catholic Church, legalized conquest and basically made, you know, specific laws governing the behavior of conquesting states. That actually got translated and brought into the laws of nations. So when you start looking at laws and large governing laws, the origins are from somewhere. Somewhere either historic or something that is has a design for something. So like when you start looking at laws under the United Nations in global governance and so forth, there may be no historic means or intentions behind it. In other words, it's not an evolutionary thing. It is a revolutionary thing where it seizes controls and so forth. And so that's why it's important, because you're probably going to find improvement in the law if it's evolutionary. Laws that are revolutionary are typically laws that should cause pause and should actually cause concern with any American citizen. So with that, let me just kind of move forward with this last part here. Ought it to be put in the power of a member of the union to drag the whole community into war? As the National Tribunal is to decide, justice will be done. It appears to me from this review that though on some of the subjects of this jurisdiction, it may seldom or never operate, and though others be of inferior consideration, yet they are mostly of great importance and indispensably necessary. Now, he's going to go on into more information and more illumination on the jurisdiction, but I want to pause right there. We'll pick up as of tomorrow, you know, the remaining comments from Madison, and then we will actually have John Marshall, who is going to pipe up a lot of information regarding jurisdiction, these same matters. This is important, my friends, because as you start looking at how they were defining the jurisdiction and so forth, we can actually start saying and applying the constrained limitations that were clearly defined. And the fact is, as they started going through all of this, this really gives you, you know, how they were focused on what these courts were to do. How much commerce was ever discussed in any of this? Really none. It was really more about injury. It was more about equity, those types of things. It wasn't necessarily about contract law. So anyway, we want to basically give you these bits of information regarding jurisdiction and the federal role in why it was to actually function, and the jurisdiction granted to the Supreme Court and constrained in these types of cases, as well as the enumerated powers. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we will have the rest of this tomorrow. God bless.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.